listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for Your Family. I'm your co-host, Dr. Melody Fox, and Alan Cardoza unfortunately had a competing appointment this morning, so he will be joining us back in the new year. So it's just you and me today, along with our guest, Cal Newport. And we'll be talking to him in just a moment. As I remind you, the Answers for the Family is a show that, you know, well, both Alan and I have over 30 years' experience of working with teens and parents in crisis. And we really want to help them. And we talk about many different subjects, such as raising teens in today's world, about finding your runaway teen, working through addictions, parenting skills, and advice, of course, and also self-care that you can use yourself as a role model for your children. And we talk about so much more than that. And today we are just thrilled to talk to another expert in what he does and does best. Our guest today is Cal Newport. He is a writer and an assistant professor of computer science at Georgetown University. And we'll be talking about his new book today. His new book is So Good They Can't Ignore You: Why Skills Trump Passion in the Quest for Work You Love. Now, Cal set out to study answers to the very simple question, why do some people love what they do for a living while so many others do not? And I think this is important, especially with our teens and our transitional age youth, as they're trying to figure out what they want to do, because the standard career advice is follow your passion, and that could be actually dangerous, so Cal reports. So most people don't have a pre-existing passion that they can match to a career, and even if you do, he suggests that evidence suggests that building and engaging a meaningful working life is more complicated than simply matching your job to something that interests you. Passion is not something you discover then follow, but instead something you cultivate by first building up valuable skills, then leveraging those skills to take control of your working life. Does that sound about right, Cal?
Well, thank you for having me. That's a very apt summary when I looked into that question of why do so few people end up loving what they do and what did they do differently. I found that this advice, follow your passion, is completely pervasive, and it's actually, as you just summarized there, leading people, especially young people, in the wrong direction.
And that's really confusing for me, because I grew up with my grandfather always saying, do what you love and the money will follow, and if you don't, you've had a great life anyway. And then we hear Oprah and other people talk about following your bliss, and you know, that's been going, being told for many, many years. So, you know, why would skills trump passion in your quest to find work that you will love?
Well, it seems that the big mistake that's been made in sort of American career advice in the last 20 years or so is confusing the goal of ending up passionate about what you do, which I think is a great goal, and it's what I think people mean when they say follow your bliss or, you know, follow your passion. The people are confusing that goal with the specific strategy of identifying a pre-existing passion and using that to choose your career. And so what the evidence suggests when you look at the research and also just my own anecdotal exploration of the lives of people who love what they do is that passion is a good thing, but it's something that's cultivated over time. And things like skills and being able to leverage those skills are really important in cultivating passion. And this idea that we just have a pre-existing calling that we have to identify doesn't really pan out.
Yeah, I mean, I could see that happening too, because if you do something and you learn to do it well, then you could develop a passion for what you do. But still, I still am the mindset, I guess, of more that passion mindset of, you know, you want to find something that you love and cultivate that and the skills and work on that craft.
Right. So what's interesting is if you ask, say, a workplace psychologist, someone who studies how do people end up feeling satisfied or motivated by their work? If you ask them what matters, what leads people to feeling satisfied or motivated, they're not going to tell you matching their work to a pre-existing interest is what was important. What the research finds is that there's more general traits like a sense of autonomy, a sense of mastery over what you do, a sense of impact, what you're doing is having impact on the world, strong connections and relationships with the people you work with and for, that these type of traits lead people to feel really engaged and satisfied with their work. But these traits have very little to do with whether or not that job matched an interest you had when you're 18 years old. And in fact, to get these traits in your working life, you often have to get very good at something first. That, in some sense, is your leverage for obtaining these more general traits that the research says really leads to the satisfaction.
Okay. Well, in your book, you talk about there's like four easy rules of getting there. What are some of those?
Well, I might not call them easy, but there are four. I split the book into four rules. So the first one, don't follow your passion. It lays out all of the evidence I found when I looked into this question of why just telling someone to follow your passion is not enough, that just doesn't match the evidence. The second rule is be so good they can't ignore you. And this summarizes the storyline I saw again and again when I studied people who did end up loving what they do, which is they started by becoming really good at something rare and valuable. And that gave them leverage and control over their career. And once they had that, they could steer their career towards these general traits that were going to make them feel engaged and satisfied. And then the two rules that follow deal with, well, what are some of the traits you can look for and how do you get them in your career once you're really good at something?
Okay. So say we have an 18, 19-year-old or a 17-year-old and they're trying to figure out what they're going to do going to college. As a parent, how would you guide them to find their craft, I guess, and learn something as opposed to following their passion and doing that?
I think the important distinction to make for an 18 or 19-year-old, and as a professor and someone who does a lot of advising with students, this comes up often, an important distinction to make is between interest and calling. So the issue that young people are facing today is that follow your passion, follow your bliss, do what you love. This advice gives them the idea that there's one thing they're meant to do. And if they find it, they'll know. They'll love it immediately and for the rest of their lives. And if they don't feel that, they haven't found the right thing. And that's an impossibly high bar for most people to be able to leap over because most people don't have a calling like that. What I tell a young person is that interest is sufficient to decide to go after something. And it's completely normal to have 5, 6, 7 different things you're interested in. Mm-hmm. That's fine. Flip a coin if you need to. But that's enough. This is interesting to me. That is enough for you to start down the path to cultivating mm-hmm. passion. So I try to sort of de-emphasize the importance of the choice and put way more emphasis on the process once you choose.
Is that how you came about doing what you're doing?
Yeah, I think that's an apt description. I actually wrote an op-ed piece about this for the New York Times, which generated some controversy, but I told my story of how I ended up as a professor. And the story I told was at the end of my college experience, I had several different directions I could go with my career that seemed different, right? I could go to graduate school. I had a job offer at a technical company, Microsoft, and then there's this opportunity to write, which is kind of a completely different thing. And because I've always sort of implicitly believed in this mindset that I talk about in the book, I didn't sweat it much. I was happy essentially flipping a coin or using pretty small criteria like location in the country to make my decision because I was confident that any of those directions could be transformed into a life that I was passionate about. So again, my emphasis was on what do I do once I choose a career path, not which of these is the one true career path for me.
Okay, so you took a lot of pressure off of yourself doing that.
Yeah, it takes a lot of pressure. And I talked about how in graduate school, especially early on, there's times that are very tough. When you're a new graduate student, for example, you just feel like you're not nearly as capable or intelligent as the older grad students around you, right? You haven't learned enough to make a contribution. It's hard and you're not gaining much traction. And I talked about in that article I wrote how that if I was trying to follow your passion mindset, that would have been a place where I might have quit because I'd say, I'm not loving this every day. This must not be my true calling. But when you think about it from more of an evidence-based mindset, that you have to build skill first and then use that as leverage to take control of your career, it was much easier to persist through that. And now I love what I do for a living.
Mm-hmm. And I think that is important because you were talking and it made me think about some clients that have come in. And even older people, not necessarily 18 or 19-year-olds, but 25, 26-year-olds that are still struggling to figure out what they want to do and where their career is going to be. And some of them get stuck and don't register for college because they don't know what path they want to take. And I try to get them to say, just pick a class. Just take one class, do one thing, because you never know what might spark an interest if you don't know what you're going to do.
Yeah, and again, I think this goes back to sort of a misunderstanding of the importance of pre-existing interest for something. So we know from the research that it's useful to be interested in something before you go after it, mainly because that gives you a sense of intrinsic motivation. Because you made the choice yourself, it was based on your interest and not pushed on you from outside, you're going to be more likely to persist through the hard work of getting good at it. Mm-hmm. But that's basically the line at which the importance of interest stops, at some sense, right? I mean, interest helps you have intrinsic motivation, but it's not going to give you love for your work. Love for your work comes after you've gotten good at something. So this is the sort of misunderstanding we have. Interest is not the whole ball game. It's just what gets you started down the path towards loving what you do. It lets you persist through those early hard stages. But there's no one true thing, one true calling waiting for you. You need to do the hard work of building some skills and then take those skills out for a spin to shape your career.
Yeah, and I was just thinking too, it's sometimes people just need to be curious about something. You don't even have to have interest in it. Maybe even just be curious on what that path is going to take. But I think there's so much pressure that, oh, we go to school and we're going to study this and that's what we're going to do for the rest of our life, so we better be very careful on what we pick, instead of just going in and starting to do something and find out if that's what you love to do. Because, you know, most people have 2 to 4 different careers in their lifetime if you live long enough.
Yeah, I think it's useful to use this analogy of career capital. I think it really helped clarify my thinking on this subject. And this says that as you get better at things that are rare and valuable, whatever they are, mm-hmm. that gives you this mythical, you know, metaphorical substance we can call career capital. And it's that capital that you invest into the traits that's going to make your working life something you love. So your focus should not be, what is the one thing I'm meant to do? Your focus should be, am I acquiring career capital? How could I acquire more of it? Because that's what's going to lead you to loving your work, not a matching problem of figuring out the exact type of work for your personality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I know in your book you talk about the craftsman mindset, and you also talk about the passion mindset. First, I want to know, what is the difference? And then when you said craftsman mindset, I think of craftsmen who are very good at what they do. They spend a lot of time doing what they're doing and learning their craft.
That's right. So the craftsman mindset is one in which you approach your work by asking, what is the value of what I'm producing? And how could I produce things of more value? How could I be more useful to my organization and to the world? That's the type of mindset that's going to lead you to acquire lots of career capital. And therefore, in turn, is the mindset that's going to lead you towards a working life that you really love. Most people, especially young people, who have grown up with the advice to follow your passion, are instead saddled with the passion mindset, which is the opposite of the craftsman mindset and has you instead ask, what does this work offer me? What is the world offering me? What is this organization offering me? Is this the thing? Do I like this? What do I don't like about this? It's very inward looking. And the danger of the passion mindset is when you're looking at what does this job offer me, you're not creating the value you need to actually take control of your career and build love for it. So I counsel young people, and I argue in my book, that if you can shift from the passion mindset to the craftsman mindset, your life will be much simpler, and ultimately your career is going to be much more fulfilling.
Okay, so it sounds, I mean, that all sounds very logical, but again, I guess in my head, I'm still struggling with that passion mindset. It was so indoctrinated into me. And then, of course, society as a whole really pushes that too. You know, find your passion, find your bliss, go after that, and instead of the other. So, you know, what has your feedback been from people from your book on really challenging that mindset?
Well, I've been getting a lot of positive feedback, especially from young people who are sort of at this point of transition trying to figure out what they want to do with their life, because the passion mindset really leads to a lot of uncertainty and anxiety. So you're constantly questioning, is this the right job for me? And this is kind of an impossible question to answer. And you can always find flaws with whatever job you have. And at the entry level in particular, there's going to be a lot you don't like about your job. So it leads young people to switch jobs quite a bit or in general just feel anxious. So there's this sense out there among young people that this follow your passion idea isn't working, they're not happy. It's not leading them to sort of career satisfaction. So they were grateful to have someone come along and say, the goal of being passionate about your work is good, but it's way more complicated than that slogan can capture. Let's talk about this like adults. Let's have a much more sophisticated conversation about how people cultivate careers they love. And this was a relief for a lot of these readers. And so that's the most positive feedback I'm getting is from the people most indoctrinated in the advice that I'm pushing back against.
Yeah, and I think it's important, too, to start thinking of things in a different way. And you mentioned, you know, young people jumping from career to career, job to job, and that happens so much, and that could be so destructive, I think, or puts a lot of obstacles in actually learning any one craft. It's, you know, jack of all and master of none, so to speak.
That's right. And if you believe, as the advice tells you, that there's one thing out there you're meant to do, and when you find it, you'll immediately love it, then you can't be blamed for hopping to a lot of different jobs. Because, of course, in the real world, no one loves their work every day, especially in the entry level, before they have real skills to offer. So if you've been told there's a perfect job waiting for you out there, you're not going to be satisfied with any real job you get. On the other hand, if you say, been told the importance is building up rare and valuable skills, that's your leverage. When you have that leverage, you can take control of your career and find satisfaction. You're able to actually stick with something, build those skills, persist like I persisted through graduate school, and end up in a place that you really enjoy.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, in your book, you talk about working right trumps finding the right work. Is that about what you're talking about?
It's another way of sort of summarizing these same ideas, that the way you work, so sort of deliberately trying to build skills and constantly asking yourself, how valuable am I to my company or organization? And how can I become more valuable? That ultimately is going to lead you much more consistently to passion than asking, you know, what is the right work for me to be doing? What job am I supposed to be in?
Hmm. Yeah, I have a listener question that had come in, and it says, our son, 19, is a sophomore in college, and my husband and I are very concerned because his major is history with a minor in English. To us, this doesn't feel like a career path that will allow him to support himself, especially since he states he has no interest in the teaching field. Can you suggest how we could talk to him about this? And I know you talk to a lot of students and probably guide them. Can you help this family here?
Yeah, majors are interesting. And in fact, it was people's dilemmas over college majors that first pointed me towards this topic. I was advising college students, and I was noticing how much they were switching college majors because they believed that there was one right major for them. And that's what got me thinking about this issue of passion in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Usually what I tell people is I don't mind pre-professional majors, but I think they're actually overrated. And the goal of a sort of strong education, especially at a liberal arts education, is to practice getting good at cognitively demanding things. So I don't care if you're a history major or a mathematics major. The job market out there is less interested in the specific skills you learned in your major than you might think. What they want to see is you have the capability of taking on cognitively demanding tasks and succeeding at them. So I would much rather see someone as an employer who was a star student in the history department than just yet another business major. Because there I found someone who took on really hard tasks. He had the right papers that needed a nuanced understanding of theory, and he did it well. That tells me that when he comes to my organization and I give him knowledge work tasks, he'll be able to tackle those just fine. So I don't put so much emphasis on the structure of the major. So long as it's hard and you do really well in it, that's good preparation for a knowledge work economy.
Yeah, and when you're saying that, it's like I couldn't agree more heartily on that. I don't think it's really what major you have, because being out in the career force and workforce for so many years myself, it's like once you graduate, nobody cares.
Yeah, it is true. And the only secret I've discovered, however, is that for whatever reason, if you throw in a minor in mathematics, everyone is very impressed by you. No matter what, if you're a history major, but you throw in a minor in mathematics, I don't know why, but people just think that you're brilliant. So that would be my only insider tip. Throw in a minor in mathematics, regardless of what else you're majoring in, and you'll be fine.
Oh, I like that. But I think, you know, mathematics, number one, people think, oh, that's really hard and really tough. But also, mathematics talks about logic and breaking things down in a logical way and thinking about things. And it's very absolute when you're dealing with numbers.
That's right. And in essence, what you see is any of the sort of classic hard science, engineering, or mathematics majors tell people that you can do logical, hard logical operations, and any of the classic hard sort of liberal arts or humanities majors helps tell someone you can write and think clearly and tackle with hard ideas. And those are two very broad and two very useful skills. So if you're choosing a classic major and doing well, then you're going to be proving the job market that you have at least one of those two really important broad skills. So you'll probably be okay.
Okay. Now, in your book, you talk about turning down the promotion or the importance of control. And then you talk about control traps. Can you talk about what you mean by those a little bit?
Yeah, so if we're sticking with this idea that you get really good, and then you use that as leverage to sort of make your career something you really love. The question is, okay, well, now that I have leverage, what do I want for it? And when I studied people who love what they do, a trait that came up again and again in their working lives is that they had a lot of control or autonomy over their working life. You know, what they did, when they did it, how they did it. The science and the anecdotal research all says that this gives you a great sense of love for what you do. So control is a classic thing you can get if you have skills to offer in return. So the first trap surrounding control is that a lot of people, especially young people, try to gain a lot of control in their career before they have the career capital or skills to back it up. They drop out of school, or they drop out of their job to start a web-based company or some such, where they don't really have any skills to back this up, and that will fail very quickly. But interestingly, there's this second control trap I studied, which is almost as common, which is once you have enough skills, valuable skills, that you really can successfully demand more control over your working life is exactly when wherever you work is going to start putting pressure on you to not do that, because you've become valuable to them at this point, and they want you staying in their organization and following whatever track in their organization makes more money or has more success for their organization. So you have to have this trap on the other side, too. As soon as you're able to actually get more control, everyone's going to be telling you to not do that and to stick on your path. So you have these traps on both ends when trying to gain this very valuable trait in your career.
So how do you break through those traps?
It's an interesting question because it seems difficult, right? If you're getting pressure to not make a move towards more control, you have to decide, am I getting this pressure because people recognize I'm not good enough yet to do this? Or am I getting this pressure exactly because I'm good enough to do this? So I found an interesting answer to this dilemma talking to the entrepreneur Derek Sivers, who's sort of well-known in the entrepreneurial community. He's someone who sold a company for $30 million and then gave all the money to a charitable trust. So he's someone who, I want to say off the bat, does not care about money for money's sake. But he gave me this great rule that I talk about in the book, which is he said, you know you're good enough at something to start using it to gain more control in your life if people are willing to pay you for it. Because money, in his terminology, is a great neutral indicator of value. You know, people might tell you you have a great idea, but they aren't going to give you money unless they really think it has value and is a great idea. And his whole career path, for example, showed this. He never moved from one job or one position to another until he was making enough money on the new thing to support himself. And that was his way of knowing that what he was working on had real value. And I think that's a great way to get through these traps. If you can get people to pay for your skills, to hire you or to buy your service or to fund your company, then you have enough value to make that jump for more control. And if you can't, you don't have that value yet.
Okay. So I just, you mentioned the control. It's like people that sell off part of their company or go in part of it, they want a controlling interest in that company.
Yeah, I mean, that's one way, that's kind of like an alternative definition of control, whereas, you know, the type of control we're talking about here is one more towards more autonomy in your mm-hmm. life. And often that's why this chapter was called Turn Down Your Promotion. For some people who really want more, say, time freedom in their life than anything else, mm-hmm. control could really mean giving up power, turning down a promotion that would give you more money but more stress, moving towards a telework, remote work location so you can have more, you know, flexibility over your time versus moving up the ranks at a company. So it can be really interesting to see how people invest control, you know, once they have some power, what that means to them.
Yeah, and I know plenty of people that, particularly in my business, that have turned down, like, supervisory roles or management roles because they really enjoyed working in the field and working with the people they love and having that autonomy of coming and going instead of being stuck behind a a desk all day and make you a lot more money, but, you know, doing that. So they are taking more control over their own life and doing actually what they love to do after they built the skills to do it.
Yeah, and, you know, it differs from people to people. So for some people, the type of control they want is exactly that. They want more control over their own time, and they'll turn down promotions or start their own company so they can have it as a lifestyle business. And, of course, for other people, sometimes control means they're able to, say, actually be put in charge of an entire division and be in charge of, say, here's our strategy, and that's what they want. They want power and impact, and control for them might mean an actual more control over a powerful entity. And, you know, that differs for different people, but the key thing is without skills, without career capital, you're never going to get that choice.
And when you talk about career capital, you write in your book that's the key to creating the work you love. Can you talk a little bit about that before we go to break?
Yeah, I think it's a useful metaphor. So if you're thinking about, you know, the better you are at skills that the market really values, the more career capital you have. And the traits that are going to make you love your work cost value. They cost career capital. So the more capital you have, the more interesting and fulfilling traits you can buy in your working life, be it gaining control over a division or being able to sort of turn down promotion and work remotely part-time for a lot of money or whatever it is you're looking for. The more capital you have, the more of those good traits you can invest. So you put your mindset on how do I acquire capital and how do I invest it wisely? And don't think about what's the right work for me? Is this the one job I'm supposed to do? It's a complete transformation of that mindset.
Yeah, that thought of, is this the one job? You know, people really get stuck that if I do that, I'm going to do it for the rest of my life.
Yeah, that's true. And the thing is, in a knowledge work economy, too, you know, 99.9% of the jobs most of us have never heard of until we get them. So, again, to sit back prospectively trying to figure out what you're going to be happy doing, you're throwing away basically the bulk of the jobs out there that you might end up in. So it really doesn't make a lot of sense to be, you know, doing this type of prospective, you know, thinking about what job will make me happy. Think about your capital. Am I acquiring it fast enough? Am I investing it wisely once I have it? That's a much more consistent strategy if your goal is to end up loving what you do.
Yeah, and I was just thinking about, you talked about there's a lot of jobs out there that people don't even know about. And I find that to be so true. I don't know about other people, but I'll go on Career Builder or MedFinders or something where they have all these career listings. And I just out of curiosity, I just look up different titles that are there and go, wow, that looks really interesting. I'd be curious on what they do in that job. And I've never heard of this before.
Right, which is why it's absurd for, say, a 19-year-old to be thinking, okay, what do I want to do with my life? Like, what job am I going to have that's going to make me happy? Because at that point, you don't have nearly enough exposure to the job market to know what the options are. This is why it makes so much more sense to think about these general traits. I want a life with autonomy. I want a life with impact. I want a life with power, whatever it is you're looking for. Think about it in terms of these general traits. Look at your options and figure which of these are you going to be most successful building up career capital in to acquire those traits. It's just, again, a much more logical, applicable, consistently workable approach to this question.
Yeah, and I just keep thinking at 18 or 19, I remember being that age and thinking I knew everything and I was so old. I look back and going, oh, you do so much growing up in your 20s and where you really get an idea of who you are.
Yeah, and what's available and what you value and you know, there's so much stuff changes that this notion of being so specific so young just doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. And we are talking today with our guest, Cal Newport. He is a writer and assistant professor of computer science at Georgetown University, and we're discussing his new book, his fourth book, So Good They Can't Ignore You, Why Skills Trump Passion in the Quest for Work That You Love. We'll continue our talk with Cal in just a few minutes with more Answers for the Family, so stand by.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, WestShield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back with more Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Dr. Melody Fox. Alan Cardoza, unfortunately, had another scheduling conflict today, so you've got me, and Alan will be back with us at the first of the new year. Today's guest, we're talking to the writer of the great new book called So Good They Can't Ignore You, Why Skills Trump Passion in the Quest for the Work That You Love. It is Cal Newport, a writer and assistant professor of computer science at Georgetown University, and welcome back from our break, Cal. And I was, you know, thinking about the chapter when you were talking about becoming a craftsman. You talk about stretch and destroy. Can you discuss what that means?
I was surprised to discover how difficult it is to get good at something. So when I was researching this book, it became clear that getting good at things is the key to building careers you love. That's how you build your career capital. So how do you get good at things? I went out to answer this question. And the first place I went was actually to a professional guitar player, the sort of practice house of a professional guitar player named Jordan Tice, because what I was interested in was, here's this guy who started playing guitar at the same age that I started playing guitar at. It was around junior high school. And I noted that by the time I graduated from high school, I was a member of a sort of mediocre rock band, famous mainly for never winning a Battle of the Bands competition after like a dozen attempts. At that same age, after playing for the same number of years, he was touring professionally. And I was thinking, well, what was different? This would be a good way for me to understand how people get good at things. So I went and I spent time with him recently. And what I noticed was how focused and difficult his practicing is. When he practiced the guitar, he would be stretching himself. He'd be stretching his fingers, literally, the speed at which he's comfortable playing. And he always kept what he was practicing just a little bit harder than what he could do comfortably. And his face would be, you know, strained, and he would breathe in ragged gasps. But the fact that he was stretching himself beyond where he was comfortable mm-hmm. allowed him to keep getting better very quickly. And I realized when I was playing back in high school, the difference was I liked to play songs I already knew how to play well. I liked to get on stage and play something that came easy to me. I did not like the pain of stretching. And this metaphor is actually applicable to knowledge work or sort of general skills that are valuable in the marketplace. Most of us avoid the mental strain required to actually pick up a new skill. Because if we're not stretching ourselves, like you need to burn a muscle or stretch your fingers on the guitar, you're not going to get better. We like to do what we already know how to do, and when something gets difficult, we go check our inbox, look at email, do Facebook, because we're uncomfortable with that strain. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in this idea that I see when I study people who love what they do, that part of their ability is that they're comfortable, they build up a comfort with that strain. They stretch themselves and they build up skills quickly, and therefore they get career capital stores really quickly. And because of that, they have real control over their careers at a young age. So this idea that you learn and practice how to stretch and destroy the type of skills that are valuable in your work is as important as learning how to stretch and destroy when you're becoming a guitar player or learning how to play chess or anything else. It could be really one of the core skills in very rapidly building a career that you really love.
Yeah, and I think that is so true. Sometimes, you know, we're challenged to stretch and we avoid it.
Yeah, there's not a lot of pressure to do that sort of stretch, especially in knowledge work. And there's interesting, you know, studies on, they call this deliberate practice in the performance psychology literature. And there's these interesting studies where they basically say just doing something a lot of times is not going to make you better at it. And what happens in, say, a standard job is that you get better at first because everything is stretch, everything is new. But then you hit a plateau, and for the next 20 years, you're not really getting that much better because you're just doing what you already know how to do and avoiding stretch. So there's this great opportunity for those who are willing to keep stretching themselves to burst through that plateau and therefore start building up more value compared to their coworkers pretty quickly. So this could be sort of the magic weapon in, if you want to sort of deploy this strategy of getting good, to love your career, this is, might be a sort of secret weapon here to get there really quickly.
Hmm. Yeah, I just keep thinking, you know, back in my first career of just always trying harder and doing better and learning the craft and finding the mentors and really learning what I wanted to learn, paying my dues, so to speak.
Yeah, and that is so important, because if you're not identifying what's really important, what do I don't know how to do that if I did know how to do would be useful, and how do I get there? How do I push myself to get there? That mindset is really incredibly powerful for building skills, but it's just so easy to avoid it these days. You know, you do what you already know how to do. As soon as something becomes hard, you check email, you use deadlines to force you to get things done. That type of mindset will basically cripple your ability to build a really satisfying career.
And part of that, I mean, especially in today's world where everything's so instant, I know you talk in the book about being patient. I just find a lot of people are not that patient. They want success. They want everything right here, right now.
Yeah, and if you look at, say, even other books in the same, you know, category of books where mine has been published, you see a lot of this. A lot of people talking about hacks. You know, here's the secret to, you know, being really successful next week. Or you don't like work? Well, here's a secret that if you just do these sort of things real cleverly, you can have a really successful business funding your exotic lifestyle in the next month. You know, it's just about having the right information, having the right sort of secret tips and tricks, and then you'll instantly be fine. And with the internet, and especially the rise of blogs about these topics, you can just immerse yourself in this world that teaches you that you're just one special, well-thought-out trick away from having this great life. And that distracts you from the reality of patiently building skills and the sort of satisfaction of building a craft, and then the real satisfaction of being able to leverage that craft to do meaningful things. It's a completely different mindset, and it's one that we're losing touch with.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, in your book, you also talk about the dream job elixir, and you talk a little bit about a story about the mysterious red fire appeal.
Yeah, so I was trying to understand, again, different people who love what they do, why they love what they do. And this brought me to this farm out in western Massachusetts. And I knew the farmers there only in that my wife and I had joined their CSA program, and we had gone out to their farm a couple times for events they held. And it was this young couple, and the young man was actually Ivy League educated, and they ran this very successful organic farm. And every time we went out there, it just seemed like they loved their lives, and it was very idyllic, and it was the cliche sort of someone with a passionate life. So when I started writing this book, I got on my work boots and I drove out there to Western Massachusetts and said, let me hang out with you. I want to understand your life and what makes this so compelling. And, you know, what I found was there wasn't a point in this farmer's life, his name was Ryan, where early on he said, I'm meant to be a farmer, and then ran off and started a farm. He sort of stumbled into it and over time built up more and more skill at farming. He started selling stuff from his parents' garden, and then he got permission to transform their whole backyard into a growing space, and he had a farm stand to make some more money, and then he rented some fields, and he went to Cornell to study vegetable horticulture. And by the time he started this farm, he had a huge amount of career capital. He was very good at what he did, so he could start a farm that was successful. And I realized what made them so happy was not that he was meant to be a farmer, but it was that he built up a lot of skill at this thing, and because of that, he had complete autonomy over his life. You know, what he did, why he did it, when he did it. And they had all these quirks in the way they ran the farm that were very unique to them. And that was a dream job elixir, that he built up skill and used it to take control of his life. This idea that you take control of your working life because you're so skilled you can dictate that. That's what made him happy and his life so idyllic, not the particular match between farming and his personality or something like that. It's non-work specific, the type of things that lead us to love what we do.
And you talk about patience. It took him a long time to get to that big farm.
Yeah, it was over a decade. You know, I tell this quote from Steve Martin in the book, which I love because I think it really captures the mindset of this patience. He talked about banjo playing, and he said the way he started banjo is he said, well, I'm going to start playing, and if I keep playing, one day I'll look up and I'll say, hey, I've been playing for 40 years. And at that point, I'll be pretty good. And that would be pretty cool. And what's interesting was it was about maybe 30, not 40 years after he started playing the banjo that he won a Grammy for his banjo playing, and has this band, you know, the Steep Canyon Rangers, that he mm-hmm. tours with and is acclaimed for. I was like, that's a great example of patience. That he's like, I'll just keep playing for 30 or 40 years, and if I do that, I'll be great. And you know what? He's really good at the banjo now.
Yes, he is.
But talk about patience, yeah.
Now, as far as, you know, you also talk about marketing and that there's missions require marketing. What do you mean by missions require marketing?
So missions are sort of the other big thing that came up commonly when I studied people who love what they did. So one big thing was they had a lot of autonomy. The other thing that came up a lot was these people had a whole mission that their working life was oriented around. So it could be a professor I talked to who had a new technique for curing diseases. It could be this archaeologist I talked to who had a, you know, TV series on the Discovery Channel, and he was all about sort of popularizing archaeology to a broad audience. His mission, his whole career had been built around. These missions build a lot of meaning and satisfaction in people's work. So I found two things about them. The first being that, just like everything else in the book, if you're not good at something first, you're not going to identify a good mission. So you have to still build capital and get good before you can identify a good mission. But then there's more nuance that seems to happen, and marketing was one of these nuances, that a good mission, once you have skill and you can identify missions, a good mission is one in which it's remarkable in some way. It's easy for people to understand what you're doing and why it's interesting and why it's surprising. And that kind of captures this notion that there's a lot of nuance in this process of building a career you love. You have to get good at things, but then leveraging those skills, it can be pretty complicated. And subtle things like this is going to be more marketable than this can make a difference in sort of how successful or satisfying your career is. And I have a lot of little examples like that in the book that says this is all more complicated than just, I took StrengthsFinders, this is what I'm meant to do, now I'm going to love my life.
Yeah, you said StrengthsFinders. I know in one of the clinics I work in, they had all its managers take that StrengthsFinders. It was really interesting to find out different aspects of yourself that you didn't really think were as high up on the hierarchy as they found. But I don't know how applicable it is to what it is I do.
Yeah, that's right. And maybe it gives you some interesting input into, you know, when you're making decisions about how to direct your working life or invest your career capital. But there's just so much more than just the introspection. And I, you know, these type of examples come up time and again in the book and just in general with these people who love what they do. This is sophisticated, subtle stuff, and you need to put a lot of thought into how you're going to build a compelling career. And you have to get past the simplistic slogans before you can have that type of more sophisticated thinking about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, I have another listener question here for you. It says, my father was very passionate about wildlife and nature photography, but never had the courage to leave his day job as a grocery store manager to pursue this career. When he passed 5 years ago, one of the last things he said to me was that he felt he missed his destiny, and he encouraged me not to make the same mistake. I know his decision was a money issue to support the family and being responsible. What is your opinion on this problem so many of us face, supporting a family or pursuing our dreams?
Well, I think it makes things a lot simpler when you think about passion as something that requires career capital and not just as, I really love this thing, therefore I'll love my career if I go make this my career. There is, for example, one of the most cliched examples of just being interested in something not being enough is actually photography. That's kind of the cliched example of someone who loves photography and then goes and starts a photography practice, full-time job in doing photography, and ends up miserable, right? Because the reality is you spend most of your time photographing the same wedding time and again, and it's not all that fulfilling. Career capital theory helps you understand this. It says the key is not that you're meant to be taking pictures and that's what's going to make you happy. It's things like autonomy and mastery and a sense of impact. And those things happen to go hand in hand with making money usually too, because if you're doing something really well enough to gain autonomy and mastery and impact, you're probably going to get paid for it too. So it gives you a different way of thinking about things. Just because you really love doing this, that it in no way implies that if that was your job that you're going to love doing it, because your job needs you to be really good at something and respected for it and have a sense of autonomy, and that requires that you're getting a lot of value for what you're doing. So when you think instead, how can I build up more career capital, and then how can I invest that wisely? It just gives you a way more systematic way of thinking about this. It turns you away from making dramatic shifts. I'm just going to completely change my career, and towards, let me build capital here. If I want to start something new, let me start small and see if I can make some money on it on the side, and then see if I can make more off of that and build my skills there and build my ability to have craft and make value out of it. And it gives you a much sort of more less risky, sort of more logical way to start building and cultivating passion, and gets you away from this idea that passion is something that pre-exists and you either follow it or you don't. And those decisions then become much less drastic. And therefore, you're much more likely to actually start making the slow changes that can lead you towards it. So it's just a different way to think about it.
And making those small changes that lead you towards it. I know in your book, you talk, one chapter is Think Small, Act Big. And you talk about missions require little bets. Is that what you mean about moving forward?
Yeah. I mean, that's a little bets is this idea that it's really hard to figure out in advance the exact formula that might lead you towards this really successful and meaningful career. So you try things and you get feedback. So photography, to use that example, well, you try something. I'm going to try to sell photos consistently, you know, at this venue. Maybe that doesn't work out. You don't make much money, but that leads you to someone else that gives you a chance to sort of do some things for his magazine. And then maybe that's a little bit more successful because you stumble into a new style that other people aren't doing. So now you can morph that into sort of a official part-time job where you get to travel every other month to places to take photos for this magazine. And now that income is sort of supplementally enough that you can go to part-time with your day job. That's the pattern that you see more often that leads people to these sort of really compelling careers, not just I quit everything and started from scratch the next day. You know, you take little bets, you try things, you see if it's valuable, you see if people will pay you for it. Mm-hmm. And over time, you build this intelligence and you sort of get to know the landscape and you find opportunities. It's smaller steps, but they're more consistently going to lead you towards passion.
Yeah, and leading you to love what it is that you're doing.
Yeah, and again, I just have to keep emphasizing there's more to loving your work than just loving the activity in advance. You really have to be good at it and get these other traits, and that really helps when you think about it that way.
Well, it sounds like your students are very lucky to have you as an advisor and helping them navigate their way through college there.
They might disagree around final exam time, but maybe other times they'd be willing to say complimentary things.
Well, that's the only time that you force them to stretch, right?
Yeah, that argument isn't as successful as I would hope in sort of calming their anxiety. They say, this is good, it's hard, you're going to stretch, you know.
Yeah. Now, a couple of the other things that you do, I mean, you also have a website that you run called Study Hacks, Decoding Patterns of Success. I'd just like to take a moment and just have you talk about what that's about. It sounds really interesting.
Yeah, that's kind of the incubator that that my books come out of. In some sense. So this is my fourth book, and all of my books basically will start with a question that's relevant to my life, and then I'll go try to understand answers to the question, and then I'll end up writing a book about it. So my first three books were for students, and they were all conceived while I was still a student myself. So those questions were relevant to me as a student. This book, this question became relevant to me when I was making the transition from being a student and into the working world, and this question was obviously relevant to me. And Study Hacks, my site, is where I explore these issues. This is where I write articles about what I'm finding and hypotheses, and because I do that, I have a lot of readers. They'll give me feedback and say, well, let me tell you what happened in my life, and let me point you towards this book. And it's this sort of great roundtable discussion, virtual roundtable discussion, that allows me to dive deep into these interesting questions that are relevant to sort of my life and a lot of people's lives.
Mm-hmm. So if people wanted to go to your website or to find that, how would they do that?
You can just go to calnewport.com, and there's a link there for the blog, Study Hacks, and a link there for my books and anything else you might want to know about me.
Well, and there's probably so much more, so your fifth book is in the works?
Not yet, but I'm sure as next time I stumble into an important crossroads in my life, a book probably won't be too far behind.
That's wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Cal, for joining us today on Answers for the Family. We're talking with Cal Newport. He wrote the great book called So Good They Can't Ignore You, Why Skills Trump Passion in the Quest for Work You Love. Thank you so much for joining us on Answers for the Family today.
No, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you. A great way to end our year. We'll be back live after the first of the year, and Alan will be back with us as well. Enjoy the next couple weeks and your holidays. May they be well and full of good health and joy and merriment. Take care and bye for now.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox right here on LA Talk Radio.